With the Wells Fargo Active Cash Credit Card, you can earn unlimited 2% cash rewards on purchases you want and purchases you need. That means you earn 2% cash rewards on what you want, like season tickets to watch your favorite team, and 2% cash rewards on what you need, like paying for parking. That's the beauty of the Active Cash Credit Card. It's ready when you are, with unlimited 2% cash rewards. The Wells Fargo Active Cash Credit Card. That's real life ready. Terms apply. Learn more at wellsfargo.com/activecash.
Have you found the keys to unlock your best trip? On a Trafalgar tour, you unlock more than just the world. We give you the key to let down your walls and make lifelong friends. The key to discovering hidden talents and fresh perspectives. From one-of-a-kind experiences to iconic destinations, Trafalgar gives you the keys to unlock your best self. Discover more at trafalgar.com/unlock. That's trafalgar.com/unlock. Tour differently.
Thanks for listening to CarCast on Podcast One.
Hey, it's Rob Riggle.
And Sarah Tiana.
And you are listening to Riggle's Pit.
Yeah, and a ham horn, and we have a new podcast.
You can find our show exclusively on the Podcast One app on podcastonesports.com, and don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts.
Every Thursday, we're going to sit around and we're going to talk about the things that really excite us, like life, comedy, sports, a lot of sports.
Ourselves.
A lot of Sarah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Kim Jong-un.
Yeah.
Whatever. It's going to be a lot of fun. I hope you join us.
Yeah, get it on. Got to get it on. No choice but to get on mandate. Get it on. Welcome to CarCast. Got a action-packed show planned for you guys today. One of our heroes, John Morton, famous race car driver, John Morton, races to this very day. He's wandering the halls. We'll bring him in a second. Now, John has driven a lot of the cars that I own, so famously the BRE 510, but he's driven it. He's done the 24 Hours of Le Mans probably five times, seven times. I've done it multiple times, and lots of great stories. So we got John out there. Tim Suddard is here. He's one of our friends, Grassroots Motorsports, and lots of publications, Classic Motorsports. He has both publications, right, man?
Yeah.
There's Grassroots and Classic Motorsports. Magazines I love, by the way. I don't look at any other magazines because I'm like pretty one-dimensional. But I get those things when we take a flight cross-country. It still feels good to hold a magazine.
Oh, yeah.
There's something about
yeah.
it. It's not everything's about the phone.
Yeah. I can't bring the iPad in the bathroom. I got to bring paper.
I like that. I agree. So lots of stuff coming up. And you just got back from Arizona with all the auctions and all the fun and all the hobnobbing with some of the least important members of some of the biggest bands in the world.
That's not fair to Mikey. He's such a nice guy.
No, tell us all about it.
It was good. You know, it's people ask, were asking me several times on social media, like, what's the big event to go to? And although we love Monterey because of the auctions and the racing and Pebble Beach and the Concorso and the Quail, the events added to the auctions. But if you want to save a couple of bucks and you're just the diehard car guy and you want to see what's out there, Arizona Auction Week really kind of fits the bill. The Barrett-Jackson is the huge event that's out there. You can go out there for days. It's fantastic.
Right.
They move like 1,700 cars. RM is out there. Bonhams is out there. Gooding and Company is out there. Russo and Steele and I think Silver Auction and whatever. There's got like six or seven auctions going on in town all within, I don't know, 30 minutes of each other. They're just everywhere. It's got to be thousands of cars for sale out there. Going across, so it was interesting. The Barrett-Jackson,
we're ribbing our friend Michael Anthony Van Halen, who's always really the nicest guy in the world. And it's one of these things when you go, oh man, Van Halen's such a great band. Like it's so sad that petty differences get in the way and they can't go out there and whatever. Oh, we're looking at a picture of you two.
Yeah, with all the Fox bodies.
With all the Fox body Mustangs. So I've said this many times. I know Michael Anthony, met him quite a few times, and I met Sammy Hagar quite a few times. And I have removed them from the possible reasons why Van Halen cannot go out.
Oh, yeah. You should hear some of the stories.
Because I know those two guys. And I've said it many times. And I've had this experience in my life many times. You can take, like, an asshole and a nice guy, and they can get along because the nice guy can absorb stuff.
Yeah.
And then you can take two nice guys, and they get along famously. But when you put two assholes in a room, and I've had this, and the thing that's funny is neither one of them thinks of themselves an asshole.
Yeah.
But you take the two assholes, and you put them together, it's impossible.
It's impossible. And it becomes this competition of who's the bigger asshole.
Right. If Eddie Van Halen was the only asshole, or David Lee Roth was the only asshole, then it would work. But now there's the two of them. I've seen it at work a million times. Like, your boss gets together with director guy who's kind of hard-headed. And I'd get along famously with director guy's hard-headed because I didn't care. Like, I wasn't, but the boss and the director guy, you'd see him fucking going at it. And it's like, because you're both assholes. That's why you're banging heads.
Yeah, you can't mix moody with a moody, says you and Prager when you guys go up on stage. You guys talk about that. Like, moody and non-moody's okay. Non-moody and non-moody's okay, but moody plus moody. You can't do
it. Yeah, that's great. That's a great analogy.
Most marriages are a moody and a non-moody.
Right.
Yeah.
Ooh, which one are you?
Most marriages.
I'm kind of a flatliner. I'm always in a good mood around the kids.
Yeah.
I don't think you've ever seen me not positive around my kids.
That's true.
I can be in a bad mood, but just never around my kids. Always like super.
Let's go out and get some. bring it into the garage.
And Lynette's not moody either. Lynette's just more easily drawn into whatever Natalia's trying to draw her into.
Natalia's a mastermind. When it comes to Lynette.
She is.
I don't want to say evil mastermind, but probably evil mastermind.
Yeah, but so is Phil. Knocked over a trash can this morning. Lynette was like, I don't want to deal. I said, he's going outside. He's staying outside. He's going to bang his paw on the door. He's going to drive it. I said, look, this dog is running over both of us. Like, we got to start laying down the law.
Yeah.
So anyway. All right. Where were we? So you, Scottsdale.
Yeah.
Michael Anthony's over there. You're tooling around, you're looking at cars, you're going to all the big auctions.
Yeah, so here's some interesting stuff for you. So last year, 2017, Arizona Auctions did $259.8 million.
Hold on, because it's easier a week from now. That's what I'm going to write a book called It's Easier a Week From Now. I do this with Matt and everyone all the time, and Rob especially, like, $59.8 million. That is just $60 million. Right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. It's ostensibly, it is $60 million.
Yeah.
It'll be much easier, not now, a week from now, when you're going, last year's, what's Scottsdale do? 19? Oh, damn it. No, 129? Yeah, right.
Yeah, just 260. 60. Okay.
So wait, say it again. 260. 260. 260. Okay.
Okay. This year, 248.
Uh-huh. So down.
Down a little.
A little. Not a lot. Little. Now, I wouldn't, that's counterintuitive to me. I feel like, hey, with the stock market all rising up and the economy going strong.
Okay. So think of this. 83% sell through last year, 84% sell through this year.
Mm-hmm. So a higher sell through, but yet a lower amount.
And fewer cars overall this year. There was
fewer cars. Well, that makes sense. I mean, for the slightly lower number.
About 300 cars total.
Uh-huh.
Fewer this year than last year.
300, and this is all the auctions combined.
Yeah.
So that 300 feels fairly significant.
Well, it's about 10% because you're a little less than that. You're at almost 3,200 cars this year, 3,500 cars last year.
So what we're saying is the sell-through is about the same. The end game is close-ish, but quite a few less cars, which means fewer cars were going for more money.
Yeah, that's basically what happened. Was some of the top dollar cars, our Jag D types and things like that, these cars that are 10 to 12 million, they sold, but they didn't sell at the top of the range. And some of them kind of struggled to meet the reserve price, which is fine. It just means people are being a little bit smarter about buying those now. Mm-hmm. People don't want to overpay for those cars because when you look at it percentages and not dollars, if you overpay by 10%, that's a lot of money. That's hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars, in some cases $1 million, if you overpay by 10%. If you have a $10 million car,
right,
you know, you want it for 8.9, you don't want it for 9.9. You know,
right.
It's just it really starts to
hold
add
on
up.
Let me write this down. But if you're selling the car,
yeah,
you would like the 9.9.
Right. So here's the thing.
I
would say overall that this year was better for buyers than it was for sellers. I think, a lot of cars sold, but they sold kind of in the down range. Like, they met the reserves, they sold, but they sold in the down range. And there was a lot of cars that were non-reserve.
Can I, and let me jump in for a second. Is it fair, in a weird way, is it fair to critique or use the reserve as a yardstick for success when you basically, you looked at a guy in a gym and you went, that guy could bench between 300 and 400 pounds, and I'm looking at a guy with skinny arms going, I don't think he's going to make three.
Yeah.
And you go, no, that's what we think. And then they go, he put up 275, and you go, that's a little disappointing. And like, not to me, because
yeah,
I knew in advance he wasn't going to get to 350.
Right.
And so when you look at these cars, Ferrari, Daytona, hey, the reserve is 750 to 850. You're like, no, Daytonas are selling for 550 to 625,
right,
you know, and the beat goes on, right? You keep looking at it, and you're like, oh, the Toyota 2000, 600 to 700. Like, it's not 700. It's 550 to
right,
6, you know. So they set these ambitious estimates.
Estimates.
And then you come in and you go, the cars were all kind of at the bottom of the – well, the bottom – It's actually pretty good.
It's still pretty good because sold, right?
And the bottom is the going rate.
Yeah.
Like,
and keep in mind that anybody out there that does have a reserve, that reserve may be more of the realistic number, just not the advertised number. And we know that because cars were still selling.
Okay? Right.
Now we get into the no reserve cars. And the no reserve cars, of course, some did well. Some did outstanding. But the general consensus across the board was there was a lot of good buys. There were some estimates, again, probably set very optimistic, and the no reserve cars were selling under those, and some of them, just based on what we know of the market, were pretty good buys.
You said, I'm trying to think, because I believe I saw a couple of what you'd like to happen from an auction standpoint if you're a buyer versus what you don't want to happen if you're a seller is the following. And I think this is correct, and you said it, but you were drinking a lot of beer, and this could have been hyperbole. You have a 458 special Stradale, whatever, Ferrari,
yeah,
at this auction, and this auction has it at no reserve. And then you have another Stradale 458 somewhere at another auction the following day.
Yeah.
And that has a reserve. And you go into this auction and the thing goes for $100,000 because for some reason nobody was in the room and it had no reserve and rules are rules. And you're walking out of there with that Stradale for $110,000.
Yeah.
Then you go to the other auction and the thing stalls out at $195,000 and it's a no sale because it didn't meet reserve.
Yeah.
If you're the dude who sold the Stradale at the one, you're not happy
you're
about
not
that.
Happy.
And if you're the dude who bought it, you're pretty happy. But you said there was, and that's a car it's hard to tell with those cars, but that's
yeah,
a 200 to 250 car.
Right.
And you said somebody bought it for
$100,000 at Gooding. There was a 458 challenge. That sold for $100,000. The hammer price was $100,000, and that looked like a great buy to me.
And
that's a cool car, right? That's
a
very
cool
car to have.
And that's a good buy. And Also, Matt tweeted out White 355, and he said, great starter car, sort of great starter investment car, whatever. And then he got a little pushback.
I guess an entry level Ferrari, I think.
Yeah, but he didn't. He said, like, a good starter car. It's like, yeah, for 100 grand, Daddy Money Bags over there.
Yeah.
So, Warbucks. So I said, I clarified it. I just tweeted back. I said, for Ferrari, it's an entry Ferrari.
Yeah.
Not like an entry car, but an entry Ferrari. That car was really nice and went for about 80 or 85,
I think. This is what I loved about the car. It was a 1999 F355 Targa 6-speed white, and I believe it was the only one made white in that year. The Targa and the 6-speed are desirable in my mind, and maybe rare. I don't know the production numbers completely. But it looked great in white. It was a great car, and I don't know what the estimate was. You know, the estimate range is, I don't know, 120 to 175 or something like that.
The estimate wasn't that high.
You know, maybe it was 100 to 150.
The thing about that car,
it was that RM.
It wasn't quite that high. He'll look it up. I think it was more of a sort of 90 to 120, or 120 was either the high or the low. But yeah, I think it was like 90 to 120. But those cars are going for 65, so. That car was sort of well bought and well sold. Like, it was a really nice car, but to the owner, it was pretty well sold because it went for 85 and those things are trading for 60 or 65 or whatever.
I think it was a good car. I think it first of all, it looked good, and I think it was the right combination of being special. And I know everybody's throwing out, it's going to cost $20,000 to do the belts and blah, blah, blah.
If
everybody's in the market for a 355, if people are in the market for a 355, you know what you're getting yourself into. By the way, I didn't read the details on it. Maybe the belts were done.
But here's the other thing, too. But back to me. Let's all focus on me.
Okay.
If you take a car, Ferrari 355, which we like a lot, and recommend as a starter Ferrari for those looking for a Ferrari investment, but they've kind of cooled down a little bit, and they're not, you know, the chart isn't, the graph isn't going through the ceiling. It's kind of flattened out on those cars,
right?
And they're 60, you know, they're $55,000 to $75,000 cars, right? If you make the reserve at 90 to 120, you're setting yourself up for disappointment, right? Matt, because it's a $65,000 car. Now, this is a really nice one, but
this isn't nice. I'm trying to find it in my app.
90 to 120. Okay. 90 to 120.
Uh-huh.
Because I saw it once.
Okay.
That's what I'm going with.
I thought the low.
It can't be 120 to 150.
No,
but
I'm saying I thought the low range was not less than 100.
Oh, maybe it was 100 to 120, but I think it was 90 to 120. But the point is 120 was the top, and it was either 90 or 100 at the bottom. But here's my point. You let Max Pata find it. He can't find it.
The Targa?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's 94. It sold for 94.
With the fees. What was the estimate?
I don't know if they kept that in there.
I know, but we've been talking about it for 18 minutes. So
I know, but that's the only number they have on the website.
No, you'd have to get the, like, it's not. They I think they remove it from the website. I think what you have to do is either physically get the catalog, which we probably do have somewhere.
Yeah.
Or you guys got to start taking like screenshots.
An app.
No, but the app. Oh, does the app tell you what the old estimate was?
It does for most of the cars.
All right. Well, you look for
99,
that.
120 to 140, sir.
Oh, you're. Well, I had the 120 part. I said no to 150, but you're right.
120 to 140. And
okay, but
the hammer was 85.
Now I'm going to do what I hate when people do, which is you're making my point, which is those cars trade for 65 to, they trade from like 60 to 80. So if you're going to make your car 120 to 140 for a car that goes for 80, then you're setting yourself up to go, it didn't meet the reserve. I mean, I may have met the reserve, but it didn't meet the low estimate.
Yeah,
and that's what I'm saying. If you're going to raise a $60,000 car up and put the bottom at 120, I knew there was a 120 in there. I just didn't know the 140.
I knew there was a 120 there as well, but I thought it was the lowest.
Then you're setting yourself up.
Well,
because that car still, at the end of the day, the guy who paid 94 with the fee, the guy paid 94 grand for a 355 paid more for 355 than anyone on the planet.
Somebody paid $24,000 for a Pontiac Solstice. So that happened.
That's why they serve booze at those things.
That's why they serve booze. And that's an end of the day car, right?
All right.
My trailer's empty. I got to get something on there before I go home.
I want you to count to 10 Mississippi, Chris, and then we'll bring in John Sutter and, Tim Sutter and John Morton.
All right.
I'll tell you guys about Amazon. Amazon Automotive. Shop auto parts, tools, accessories, quickly and easily from your phone, your computer, your tablet. Plus, free shipping on millions of items. Did you say Mississippi? And no, Prime.
There's a clock in front of them.
For Prime members. That's right. Massive selection of parts, accessories, tools, fluids, even tires. Top brands like K&N, Bilstein, Chemical Guys, Bosch, and more. Tired of looking up part numbers and reading catalogs? With Amazon, all you need is the year, the make, and the model. You put that in, and you save it. So you
I just bought
keep popping it on.
Throttle position sensor for an M3.
Use the M3.
Yeah.
Use customers question and answer to and product reviews to research and buy your part. Amazon can help you research and ask vehicle purchase as well. So you check out amazon.com/vehicles. Find reviews, specs, images, all that. So look, point is the day of you standing out in the parking lot of the Pep Boys is over. You're on Amazon, man. You get all those parts, set up your account, and there we have it. Tim Sutter is here. Always good to see Tim again.
Hello.
Do my friend John Morton. Always great to see John Morton as well. Grassroots Motorsports Experience is coming up at the Rolex 24 Hours of Daytona. That is today, not as we tape this, but as you hear it, today through Sunday. Classic Motorsports Orange Blossom Tour, that's coming up March 4th through the 8th. And then there's the MIDI, that is over at Road Atlanta. That is April 27th through the 29th. John Morton, you'll be where?
You'll be at our MIDI event.
You'll be at the MIDI event. John famously drove for BRE and had that unbeatable 510, but also 24-hour Le Mans so many times. And we have, and all the time, and all the vintage races as well. How many cars will you drive over the course of a weekend at the Monterey Historics?
The most I ever was to drive was 5, but I wrecked the third one and the Scarab and never got to the last two.
So, cuts down on your action a little bit.
Yeah, so the most, I think I may have driven 4 at one time, but this was the first time it was going to be 5, but it didn't work out.
I loved it when I went by the pit, or not by the pit, but the paddock many years ago, and it had that couple that ran the Sunbeam Tiger you drive, the white one. And I was looking at it, and I said, who does these tires or something? They looked a little hand-grooved or something. And the guy's like, that's my wife does it. And I thought, you get your wife to do that?
Yeah.
Wow, that's a keeper, man. I don't think my wife would be down with getting out the soldering iron.
No, she does everything. He just points.
Really?
Yeah, he just points because he's a little too big to really even get in the car. So if it ever has to go in the trailer, she has to be the one that drives it.
That's a good woman right there. Yeah, we're looking at that John driving that Sunbeam right now.
Yeah.
And Tim. We're happy to see. I want to know your overall. I'll set the table and then you come in and eat.
All right.
We have noticed really like an explosion in the vintage motorsport world. In the past 7-8 years ago, you'd show up to Rolex Historics and the bleachers weren't full. You know, it wasn't crowded, so to speak. They got a good turnout with the cars, but somehow it wasn't in the zeitgeist. And the cars weren't that expensive and there was plenty of room to walk around. And now these cars are some of the most expensive cars going across at auction are the race cars. The vintage stuff is getting expensive. The stuff from the 80s and the 90s that wasn't considered vintage a few years ago is now somehow expensive and considered vintage. Tell us where you think the sport/hobby is going and where it's gone over the last few years.
All based on subscriptions to your magazine.
Yeah, it's only an hour show, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I think first off, as you know, you go to modern car races and the cars all look the same now. You know, NASCAR and to some extent, IMSA is better than that, obviously. But as cars start to look more and more the same, I think people want to see stuff that looks different. I also think you look at your demographics, your baby boomers are aging, and they love the stuff from the 60s and 70s, and they still want to see that. And the racing's, as John can attest, and I vintage race an old Triumph TR3, you know, they always say vintage racing is just exhibition. That's bull. I hear you swear all the time, so I guess we
swear away.
I try to explain to people, like when I used to teach boxing, you can't really have people spar half speed. It doesn't work because one guy gets punched in the nose and the other guy goes, well, I'm going to go 5/8 speed now and get him back. And then that guy goes 3/4 speed. Yeah. And you can't tell a bunch of competitive guys like to go sort of nurse their car around the track. They're going to race.
Well, you've run Monterey. I remember the first time I ran out there and Steve Earle's constantly saying it's a drive, you know, it's just a car show on wheels and we're going to take it easy. And I said, all right, you know, I don't want to be that dick that messes everything up. So I was like, I'll go easy. And some idiot in the 911 came whizzing by me through the dirt. I said, okay, this is just like an HSR race back east. We're racing.
You're going to go. Yeah, we saw that as well when we went to the Goodwood Revival. And I mean, and some of these cars are, I mean, we saw an all Ferrari race. I don't think there was anything on the track worth less than maybe $7 million.
Right.
And everybody was out there like their life depended on it.
Oh, well, look, I think when we went last year with the 935, this first practice session got black flagged, and then the second one got black flagged, too, because guys couldn't even practice without getting into each other. Like, it's weird. They're like, they weren't even qualifying sessions. They were literally practice sessions, and they both got black flagged. Like, because the guys in the Decon Monzas like couldn't keep it in their pants, you know. Yeah. And it was like, I get it. I mean, it's a self-selecting group. If you see a Decon Monza and you see a guy go, I want to drive that car, that guy's not going to nurse it around. It's not wired for nursing cars around tracks. If you ever see that car or 935 or whatever.
He's got anger issues.
Also, it's called a race car.
Yeah. Yes, well, he got a race.
You know, he got a race.
Every driver's meeting at Laguna Seca at the big, you know, the big race, they always say, who wants to win the race? And nobody's supposed to put their hand up or they're in trouble.
Right.
Of course, so they're all lying because everybody wants to win the race.
It's a trick question.
Yes. And there's, again, none of those guys would be there. If you went to a random Whole Foods market and selected, you know, 182 dudes who were in the kale department, you might then have a group of guys who would, in fact, nurse their cars around the track. But you don't have these guys. Everyone came out from Florida and they're angry and they got their Decon Monza. Those guys aren't into nursing cars around track.
No.
You're not going to find 182 dudes at a looking for kale in Florida. I don't know how it is out here.
Not in Florida.
Whole Foods out here.
The Whole Foods is in Santa Monica. Yeah.
You know, kale's not really that bad.
Neither is steak.
That means he's slowing down.
Yeah. John Morin just made kale cool. Yeah.
So, John, how many times did you race in the 24 Hours of Le Mans?
I raced there 9 times.
And 9 times.
The first time was the time your car finished second. And I was in a 935 that year. That was 79.
Yeah, I had a – but you tell me if this makes sense or not. I was sort of interested in – you know, we all know Bruce Myers and his 935 that came in first and Whittington Brothers and all that good stuff. And it's a great story. But I kept kind of saying there were so many prototypes still back then and they were so much faster. Why 1-2 with the 935s? And somebody said, it took a while to get this answer, but I think Bruce said, oh, it was raining the whole time and those cars had windshield wipers and could actually kind of get around the track. A lot of the other stuff was open cockpit stuff, and in the deluge, they weren't able to navigate it, or the horsepower didn't make a difference, or whatever. But tell us your experience.
My experience is our engine blew up just as the rain started, so I didn't even have to drive in the rain. The car was out.
Well, you had time to watch it then.
Yeah, I went back to bed and got there for the finish. I think it was probably because they were extremely reliable.
Yeah, they're well sorted.
Yeah, as far as the, you know, for our, Phil Hill won three times with an open car. The cars used to all be open, so I don't think that was so much of a factor.
Maybe again, maybe if it's raining the whole time, though, I'm guessing that the car with the extra horsepower just doesn't have the same advantage that it had when it was driving. What were you? You're driving a 935, but what? Which 935 was it?
It was an Interscope car.
Oh, with like the double zero.
Yeah, the zero. It was with Milt Minner and Ted Field, who owned Interscope before he got into the record business.
It's a beautiful car.
Yeah,
it's that black and sort of like orange or white livery, like you know the Interscope car.
Yeah, I think so.
They. Gunnar Jeanette, I think, was racing one in my race.
Okay.
Put on the pole over there. It's actually the only time my wife has ever been interested in car racing, which is we're watching the documentary, The Defiant Ones, which is about the rap scene and Dr. Dre and all that whole world.
Yeah.
And she was in there watching that, and I was in there watching my car shows, and our worlds crossed for a second because she went, Interscope, the Interscope label, and they showed a picture of the guy with his, like, 935. It's like, I know that car.
Yeah.
And she's like, huh?
What?
like, all of a sudden, there was a dialogue about 935s that lasted a minute and a half, and then we went to our separate rooms again. Yeah, it's a beautiful, it's a great looking,
it's a great fantastic.
Looking car. And they had some 935s, they had some 934s, and like 934 and a halfs, and all the iterations as well. This is a great looking car. So you ran about how many hours that
about
race?
About 11 and a half, something. Just as it started to rain, the engine blew up.
And went back, and we also had lots of questions about the 300ZX with your name on it at the other shop, because we're trying to figure out, like, was there a V6 in it with a turbo, or was it the only V8 car and it always ran with a V8? We're looking at a picture of it.
Yeah, I took this morning.
Looking at a picture of it now.
Because we know about the 8 chassis, but we're wondering, were there 8 individual chassis made, or did like number 3 become number 8 or number 4 become number 8? Or
there are no number plates or anything.
Yeah, you know, the guy to ask is Clayton Cunningham, who owned the team.
And
I'm not sure how good his memory is. It's probably pretty good.
I was just going to say, he's a little wishy-washy.
But you guys got to remember, nobody cared back then.
Nobody cared.
Well, you know, you threw it away at the end of the year. What difference does it make?
It makes a big difference now.
Yeah, it sure does.
It makes all the difference now.
Yeah. Well, the early cars were not transaxle cars. And the car that won Le Mans was a transaxle car. But which one, I wouldn't know the number.
Mm-hmm. Well, we know Steve Millen has that car. That's his car. That's and I think we have the last car, which is the V8 car, because they went to the Infiniti.
Well, V8. Speaking of Steve Millen, he sent me a note yesterday, and he said, do you think I might be allowed to bring the Le Mans car to the MIDI? And I said, yeah, I think that would be okay.
And thanks for asking.
Yeah. I was pretty surprised to get that email yesterday.
He's such a polite guy.
He really is, yeah.
Not really.
not on the racetrack, I'm sure. But
everybody's nice to magazine guys, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
He almost killed me because he tried to we saw him.
He's the nicest guy, except almost killed me.
No, this was not. We were in Monterey a few years ago, and we saw him swung by his pit, his paddock. And he's like, Adam, get in the car. And I was like, I don't think I fit in this car. He's like, you'll fit.
Yeah.
And then I started like, I mean, that is a tight, that is
it,
a tight
took a minute.
Car.
Yeah, but it's worth it to make yourself fit in, right?
It is, but man, those cars are snug. So, let's see, do we have any questions? Or
yeah, we have a listener
calls,
email here.
Listener email.
Yeah, and if you guys want to write in, all you listeners out there, just go to carcastshow.com, click the contact page, and we'll read the
You know what? I'm not
show.
Interested in this. I want to talk to these guys more. I don't want an email.
All right, never mind.
I'll tell you what, though. First, let me tell you guys about Geico.
Geico.
Everybody's got a to-do list. You know, you're dropping off your dry cleaning, you're picking up some milk, and you should save hundreds of dollars of car insurance to that list. You don't have to drop off or pick up anything. You can just go to geico.com, and in 15 minutes, you could be saving 15% or more on car insurance. So if you need some extra money, you're going to go to the races or buy some more car parts like I do. This is the most rewarding to-do you can do today. Go to geico.com.
All right, so let's see. So I never really, we never really got too far down the road in this question. The hobby of vintage cars, vintage racing, all that stuff. I found it's grown a lot, but you would know better than anyone on the planet, Tim.
Well, our paid print circulation's up 25% in the last 18 months. So, yeah, we're experiencing quite a growth spurt. The other part of the growth is coming from younger guys. Well, you've seen it. A 240Z was a $5,000 to $10,000 car mm-hmm. forever. Yeah. A nice one, just a street car. A nice early Z car is a $35,000 car, and that's happened only in the last 2 to 3 years. E30 M3s shouldn't have sold those cars for $12,000.
No, right. I think one just sold for $109,000.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Oh, wait a minute. Those are both cars I've had sold. I was laughing a second ago. Yeah, and John, you must enjoy seeing the love and respect these Japanese cars. I mean, the ultimate respect, which is the pocketbook. The prices on some of these Japanese cars, I mean, mainly Nissan and Datsun, but Toyota as well, they used to just be kind of neither here nor there. Like, if you wanted to go vintage racing, look, you had to have a Porsche or Ferrari or Mercedes or BMW. And if you had a Datsun, it was...
Or a Triumph.
Or a Triumph. Or an Alfa.
There's like a couple of guys. And an Alfa. A couple of grassroots guys.
Or something like that. But the Japanese stuff wasn't multi-tens of thousand dollars. No. Now, these cars are getting expensive.
Yeah. Well, that's because you're buying them all.
Yeah, maybe they're not really expensive.
But you touched on the street cars as well, not just the race cars. We're starting to see more of the really nice, clean Japanese race cars show up at the prestigious auctions and start pulling in some pretty decent money for those cars. Yeah, now they're worth restoring or fixing up or pulling that low mile one out of your garage and doing a little work on it and getting it fired up and see if you can get $40,000 for it.
Yeah, you know, to be honest, when I started driving for Datsun, I thought they were really ugly. I didn't care much for them.
Yeah, you can and, say that now.
They grew on me, and the Japanese cars have grown on me. But, you know, early in the history of the Monterey Historics, Steve Earle wouldn't allow a Japanese car until they finally had the 30th anniversary of our Trans Am championship there, and he let that car run, let the BRE car run.
But now it's commonplace, and that's nice for us fans. And there was a kind of a there was a snobbery. I think it was,
absolutely.
Right? It was just snobbery.
Yeah.
It really didn't have anything to do with anything because the cars were more than qualified to be there in terms of racing, winning records, championships,
right.
And all that stuff. So you say your circulation is up 25% in the last 18 months. I mean physical copies
print,
of the magazine?
Print paid, yeah.
Print paid.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. I don't think there's any other magazine that can say it's up. I mean, everyone's that industry's dying. Everyone's going to the computers.
Everyone's getting out of the books and going to videos.
People still want good information and present it in an interesting way. And our web stuff's doing fantastic, too. But people, especially the older guys, although we have lots of younger guys reading it too, they want it, they respect it, and you know, as it gets harder to get, we lose competitors, we gain market share.
Yeah,
so
probably because the last time you were here was 18 months ago.
Yeah. So the MIDI's coming up April 27th through the 29th. I think I went about
10 years ago, I think.
I was about to say 10
never
years
been,
ago.
So tell me what to expect.
It's beautiful.
I mean, we started, it started before me, but it's been going on since the late 70s and, you know, a long time. And we had our 40th anniversary. I guess the math is good on that.
Yeah.
And last year. And we really, when we started Classic Motorsports almost 15 years ago, we wanted to let the vintage racing world know that we were serious about becoming the dominant magazine in the field, and we decided that hooking up with a big event or that could be a lot bigger was a good way to do it. And we really, you know, I don't know if it's copyrighted, but we really tried to make a Monterey of the East that was not as snobby. I like Monterey. It's fun, but, I mean, it's expensive. It's mostly wealthy people. You know, the hotel rooms are $100 a night at our event. And
It's Monterey for poor people, yeah. is what he's saying. Sounds fantastic.
How about normal people, not poor people? But, I mean, we have a lot
There's
of people.
No middle ground. You know,
it's super cool seeing hundreds of people in cars camping. And people, it looks like you're in the 70s because people are camping with their 240Zs and their Triumph TR6s and their Porsche 356s. It's pretty awesome.
How is the attendance? So I was there about 10 years ago. It seemed pretty well attended, but I don't recall, you know, I wasn't waiting in long lines to use the bathroom or anything.
Yes, it's gotten bigger and bigger. Last year on Saturday especially, it was tough to find a parking place. We've partnered with Hagerty Insurance. Of course, they're great promoters, and they're the presenting partner on this, and they've really helped us promote it. This year, Nissan corporately has gotten involved, so it's nice to have some corporate involvement.
Is that the featured marquee this year?
Yeah, Nissan's the race car? Our featured mark. That's why I asked John. I had dinner with John the other night. He's going to be our grand marshal. We're trying to get you to come.
Is Bob Sharp coming out there?
I'm not sure about Bob yet. So we're working on it.
He's in Florida now, right?
Yeah.
It's not too far, too far out.
So.
Yeah, we're going to try to work on getting out there, too. It's a great track. It's a great event. I will tell everyone this. Two tips, that as I recall. I think I stayed in Atlanta. I think I did a show in Atlanta.
I think you did.
And then I drove out the track. It's a little bit of a drive if you're going to stay in the city to the track. So you may want to stay closer to the track. And on Sunday, bring your own beer. Because I walked into a liquor store on Sunday. I was like, let's get a six-pack for the track. I wasn't driving. And I walked in and I was like, oh, the beer's all locked up. They must have a bunch of gangbangers stealing beer out here.
Like paid cans
of
beer.
So I walked to the counter. I was like, hey, man, unlock the beer. I got a white guy here. I want to buy some beer. And he's like, we're not selling beer on Sunday.
Not to your
you
kind.
Heathen.
And I'm like, somebody should tell you at the airport. This is information. I'm going to the track without a beer.
As soon as you book a flight there, it should pop up on your app, like your American Airlines app. Warning, no beer on Sundays.
Well, don't worry. We'll have beer for you Sunday, I promise.
Thank God I was able to find some very gracious people to give me a beer when I got to the track. So that is... If people want tickets to that, should people just go to your website, classicmotorsports.com?
They can get there through there, but themitty.com is a simple way to directly order tickets. And we have VIP packages and standard tickets, camping passes. It's all there.
And also the Orange Blossom Tour, which is going to take place before that. That's March 4th through the 8th. I'll tell you what. Let's talk about what that Orange Blossom Tour is, and just to give a little love to John, if you want to hit him up, johnmortonracing.net. I'll tell you guys about Amazon, and then we'll get into the Orange Blossom Tour.
All right.
Shop for auto parts, tools, accessories, quickly and easily. Do it from your phone, your computer, your tablet. I think just about everything Matt has put on his Mustang has been either basically bespoke, or he's got it. If you can buy it, he's got it from Amazon.
Should see the tax receipts that I have that I bring into the accountant every year, all from Amazon, because you can go through your order history. I can just print it all out. It's fantastic.
Tired of looking up part numbers and reading catalogs? Amazon is all you need. Use customers' Q&A and the product reviews to research and find the right part. I think you pretty much just log your car. You put in your model and your make and your year and all that kind of stuff, and then you just can find all the parts, all the brands you want, K&N, Bilstein, Chemical Guys, Bosch, more, all there. Go to Amazon.com/autodeals to start shopping today. That's Amazon.com/autodeals and start shopping today. Orange Blossom Tour. How does that work, Tim?
Well, that started innocently enough with I got so tired of people saying, oh, Florida sucks, Florida's flat, Florida's got no good driving roads, and I've lived there most of my life. And I said, you know what? That's bullshit. There's plenty of cool places in Florida. So about 10 years ago, we just said, we'll put this old Florida tour together where we drive all through the spine of Florida. It's actually got some pretty cool roads. We go to the beaches some too, and it starts and ends around the Amelia Island Concours. So it's a real cool bucket list deal to come down early, run with us on the tour for 4 or 5 days, and then we drop you off right at Amelia, and you have a VIP experience at Amelia Island Concours, which, if you've never been to that, is one of the most amazing events. I'm blessed. I get to go to places like Monterey and Goodwood, and Amelia Island Concours, man, it holds up to any of these events, and a lot very friendly atmosphere. And
yeah, we were there last year.
Yeah, Amelia's.
I judged your class.
Amelia's great.
So judgy.
And yeah, I was a judge in. I was doing like the GTP like the, cars.
It was like the Japanese race cars. It was like you and Tommy Kendall and Peter Brock.
Yeah, so I just went, which ones are you guys voting for? I said, all right, I'll vote for
let
that
me hold
one.
Your beer. You pick a car.
You both are tall and knowledgeable.
Yes. I judged a class with about six cars that I'd never heard of. But I had experts with me, so yeah. It all worked out okay.
The first year I judged there, you know, it's a big honor to get asked to judge at the Amelia Island Concours.
Yeah.
I got tasked with beach racers, you know, from the turn of the last century, and I didn't know anything about them. Even though I live in Ormond Beach where they all raced, I was like, so I was going to call Bill Warner and say, Bill, I'm a, you know, 50s and 60s sports car guy. What the hell? Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, I said, now calling him the first year you get asked to judge and asking for a different class might be a bad move. So I boned up and read a couple of read a couple books on the subject. Now I get up there and, you know, 1906 Blitzen Benz, 106.23 miles an hour. And then for the rest of the day, everybody looked at me and said, Tim, what do you think? You obviously know all about these cars. And I'm like, shit.
So you judged the class where Adam's 300ZX was in. Yeah, because I remember he didn't win anything.
Well, he did win an award. I think he was second or third.
I think he got the award for last person to display a car.
Wait a minute. Was it a 300? Oh, it was a 300ZX.
It was the championship car.
Yeah.
But wasn't the Roadster in there too, or that maybe wasn't in the judging? I think the Roadster
was there too. Was it in the judging?
I don't know. I can't remember. The Roadster is
so many days, so many cars.
Frank Moniz drove the Roadster, but I think John probably drove it too.
I drove it the next year. If we had a D production and a C production race, we'd run one car in C and one in D, and the only difference was the carburetor. So I drove that car several times as well.
Oh, the only difference between the C and the D, because they're both Roadsters, 2000 Roadsters.
1600 and 2000.
No, they were both 2 liter Roadsters.
They're both 2 liters. One's with the had the sort of SUs, and the other had the Webers
the
or whatever.
McCooney's, right?
Right.
Well, McCooney's and Hitachi's,
right, but one was the single barrel. And the other was a double barrel side draft, whatever. Yeah. So let's talk about that just on a selfish note, because I'm trying to figure out the whole story. I, by the way, got the Hino transport.
I know that's
as well.
Yeah, it's working on that right now.
Tell us all you know about BRE or when you began with BRE and the sort of chronology of it. Which cars did they start with? I know they ended up with the Zs and probably started with the Roadsters, but go ahead.
You got 60 seconds.
Go ahead.
Peter Brock started the team with Hinos, but very few people know much about those. When it started with Datsun was probably late 68, and I went there in early 69, and they already had your car racing with Moniz, the first Roadster. That was the first BRE car, Datsun. And I was hired really as a fabricator with an understanding with Pete that I'd get a tryout when the second car was finished. So I ended up basically doing most of the second car myself in a real hurry, even though it came out nice.
The second Roadster.
The second Roadster. And then by the time I finished it and it raced, and I became the driver.
Tryout went pretty well then, didn't it?
Yeah, it went well. The first one wasn't that great, but yeah, it did go well, and then I became the number one driver.
And that car or those two cars did what historically?
the car you owned won its I think it's division, what they called the division, and we had the pole at the first. At the Daytona runoffs, I had the pole. And
68 Frank, was yeah, it was at Daytona. 60, yeah.
69.
69. 69. Okay, that's right. Yeah, you're right.
And Moniz was second, and we had had nothing but reliable cars, but we both blew up on the first lap, and Jack Scoville won in his car. My car, the next year, I had the pole at Road Atlanta, but because I was the fourth in the championship, because we had to run the Z and didn't get to run the Roadster much, and they only took the first three unless you were out of unless one of your division didn't run. So we got the pole by a lot and at Road Atlanta, but weren't allowed to race. That was the year that the Z car won the first year.
But then where was the 510 in this mix?
Hadn't been done yet.
The Z car came before the 510.
Yeah.
Oh.
And then
That
510, which you also owned in an unrestored condition, won two national championships with Bob McQueen driving it.
Wait, do I have that 510?
You have that. No, you have that Roadster.
I have that Roadster. Yeah. Yes.
So there you've got
sucks
both
to lose.
I forget
which cars you have.
I got excited for a minute. I got a 510.
Free 510.
You're going to love it.
Actually, the Roadster the second Roadster you own has much more history than the one you have already restored.
Oh, really?
Because it won two national championships at Road Atlanta with
Were there the first two BRE Roadsters?
Yeah.
So those are the first two. Oh, good.
The first two BRE cars were Roadsters, and then the next two were Z cars, and the next were the 3510s.
So there were three. We're looking at pictures of them coming out of the Hino. So the 3510s, one of them was the one you were just unbeatable in, and that's at the Nissan Motorsport Museum or something?
Yeah,
Nissan?
They've always
Nissan's bringing that car to our Classic Motorsports Media event, so people be to see that.
The other is a Bobby Allison car or I guess we call it guest driver car or something. Yeah. I think that's my car. And then the third car is where? Do we know?
No, and the car that was really the guest car wasn't the Bobby Allison car.
Oh, it wasn't.
The guest car was sold to became a good friend, Tony Menchaca in Mexico, and he kept in perfect shape, but in a race it was totally destroyed, so it no longer exists.
So are there only two BRE 510s then?
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess I'm the BRE guy.
That I know of. There were some that we built five cars, three team cars and two customer cars.
Mm-hmm. The customer cars didn't have the BRE livery, obviously.
They had a version of it, I think.
Yeah, they're like more solid color.
Yeah, different, yeah.
So there were three BRE team cars.
Right.
And one of those has been destroyed.
Gone.
And then the other two privateer cars may be around somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah.
Interesting. All right, let's get that other Roadster restored.
Yeah.
Huh?
I forgot we had that.
Yeah,
let's bring that.
No,
up
I've
here.
Known about it.
Yeah,
I didn't know it had more history than the other car did.
Well,
but
Bob McQueen bought it at the track after we qualified on the pole, but we couldn't race. He bought the car
at Road Atlanta,
yeah,
and won the next two runoffs with that car.
Yeah. Well, I gotta say the Roadster. That car, that's won the Rolex Historic whatever trophy at that. I didn't win the race. I just got the whatever the Rolex cup.
Right.
The cup.
The cup,
yeah.
Not a watch.
The car was exciting because it has no windshield, really.
Yeah.
I didn't have an aero helmet. I'm a little bit taller than John, and my head was just banging around the whole time.
Yeah.
And it made for a real visceral driving experience.
It
like, it really. Yeah, and it's like, it's not. There was no room between the stick shift in my right leg and the steering wheel. I remember that. Like the room between the steering wheel and the stick shift is about 4 inches. But it was a visceral experience. Like everyone should have the experience of the open cockpit minus the windshield. It really wakes you up. Like it's a different. You're going slower than you are in a 935 or the Z car, but that's a more closed. You feel like you're in a capsule.
Yeah.
You have a roll cage all the way around and everything else. Oh, there's a car.
Yeah, every time Peter Brock comes by, he tells me like something new about the car that I've never even heard of. Oh. And he was here not too long ago before Monterey last year. And that front air dam, that front air dam that's on the car, he said you weren't allowed to have a splitter, but you were allowed to have brake ducts. So he designed brake ducts, but the brake ducts start almost from the front of the car where the cooler is, and then when they scoop back to the brakes, it creates like this splitter effect, and he said the next year everybody had that because he said it worked really good.
The last time I talked to Pete Brock, he told me that Hillary Clinton was responsible for sinking the Lusitania. I don't know if you know that. Yeah. So we don't talk cars.
No. Yeah. He usually gives me like a car back.
Politically, he's got some interesting ideas.
I love that guy. I love it. I love his email. Yeah. All right, let's go out on a laugh. The website, classicmotorsports.com, and then there's Grassroots Motorsports. I have the magazines. I always get the magazines. Tim,
thank you,
dutifully sends them over. And I got to say, they're not sitting around here in a pile because like when I hit the airport, first thing I do is pack those magazines. I sit, it's the only old school magazine I sit around and read in. They're beautiful. I think they've had my cars and stuff in there before. I think there's more coming, I believe. I just did a photo.
Unfortunately, that's the competitor magazine.
Oh, screw those guys.
Yeah.
They took the picture and I just flew in the bird.
They'll be out of business by the time it comes out anyway.
That's right. He's going to own that magazine before it publishes.
I'm working on it.
All right. And johnmortonracing.net is where you can go to find out anything John Morton. And, of course, the MIDI and the Orange Blossom Tour, and it's all coming up. So just go there and find out everything you want to find out. Oh, Atlanta. I'll be at the Buckhead Theater February 8th. Damn, I wish it was more
you write that off
in
huh?
April. Yeah.
Let's reschedule.
Me and Dennis Prager know Safe Spaces. Washington, D.C., Kennedy Center, February 9th, doing stand-up. Sacramento doing stand-up. Just go to AdamCroll.com and Matt Motorator. You can check him out at Shift and Steer and go to the website. Go to Corolla Drinks and see what we got going there. We got to pay for all this racing, people. Come on now. So, until next time, it's Adam Carolla for Tim Sutter, John Morton, and Matt, the moderator, DeAndrea, saying keep the air in the spare and the bag in the wheel.
For the latest updates and call-in times, follow the show on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at CarCast Show. If you'd like to write in, fill out the form on CarCastShow.com, and don't forget to give us a nice rating on iTunes. CarCast is a Corolla Digital production and is produced by Chris Loxamana. For more information, visit carcastshow.com.
With the Wells Fargo Active Cash Credit Card, you can earn unlimited 2% cash rewards on purchases you want and purchases you need. That means you earn 2% cash rewards on what you want, like season tickets to watch your favorite team, and 2% cash rewards on what you need, like paying for parking. That's the beauty of the Active Cash Credit Card. It's ready when you are, with unlimited 2% cash rewards. The Wells Fargo Active Cash Credit Card. That's real life ready. Terms apply. Learn more at wellsfargo.com/activecash.